I hear the train a-coming, it's rolling around a bend, and I ain't seen the sunshine since I don't know when. I'm stuck in Folsom Prison, and time keeps dragging on. But the train keeps rolling.
Welcome back to Voices from the Front Lines, and we're on the phone with Eric Mand, and this is a back and forth with myself and Eric. Obviously, as everybody I would hope knows, I mean, I'm the lead organizer of the Bus Riders Union, and Eric is the director of the Labor Community Strategy Center, and so we're deep comrades and also obviously one of the co-hosts of this, you know, show here on KPFK called Voices from the Front Lines. Eric, you know, I mean, you asked, you know, the question around what's the tactical plan for the working class in a time period when in a period of counter-revolution, and we're essentially the forces are essentially against most of the work that we do to even win some of the minimal reform. I mean, as you know, we've had a lot of conversations here on the show of, you know, we're in a period where essentially people want to literally, like, legally lynch, you know, blacks and Latinos, and we're attempting to sort of stop those moves, and yet from every corner we turn around, you know, during this whole fight. It's interesting for us, you know, our struggle has been sort of the crossroad or the intersection between, you know, the growing police state and, you know, how 50% of a whole LA city budget goes to the LAPD. At the same time, the importance of transportation and civil rights, the lack of access and ability for people to be mobile in this whole massive county with, you know, very few job opportunities and educational opportunities. At the same time, the opportunity to really raise the question around the environment as being an important, you know, source for us. And yet we're so, in some ways, small enough to only be able to sort of engage in one struggle at the time and do it effectively as we did with this fare increase. And yet in this city council, at this year's city budget, you know, the mayor, again, even though he was an important ally in this struggle, was an adversary in the struggle to have more cops in the street. I mean, while he could apologize and the chief could apologize about the actions about May 1st, they still were able to put another 650 cops on the streets of Los Angeles. And at the same time, also pretty much did not do anything on bus-only lanes on Wool Street, which is on the verge of being cut completely. And, you know, I guess in some ways the only thing I could think of is, you know, so part of the optimism that I've had and part of the thing that influenced yourself and me and many folks at the Strategy Center was my trip to Venezuela, you know, because at one hand, I think that the only thing that we can know right now that is clear for me of what to do is strengthening myself and strengthening the leaders that, you know, that we've been building throughout the last 10 years. You know, it's interesting. I've been in the movement, at least with the Strategy Center, for the last 8 years, and I've seen the growth, you know, and it's hard, I think, for people of my generation because we're so embedded to have, you know, instant gratification. Like, if we don't win the revolution today, it's hard for us to view the struggle takes 20 years, 30 years, 40 years. And really, the revolution is going to be won by people like Barbara Lott Holland, who was on the show, or Mark Anthony Johnson, who, you know, was on the morning show, talking, you know, describing his beautiful artistry that he has around spoken word, or people like, you know, Haywan and Richard, who were on Soul Rebel Radio here on KPFK. I would say, to me, that's the most clearest. Just as some revolutionary gave in a book to Hugo Chavez, the only thing I could do is engage in this struggle daily, teach people sort of the basics of the empire, and build their leadership in a period where it seems pretty impeccable to try to win some of these important things that we're trying to merge. And yet I also feel like at the same time we're being able, day by day, winning different forms of battle of ideas. You know, I think folks talk about this, you know, in the left, and yet it's very abstract for a lot of folks to do it. And yet we've been able to do it through this campaign where, again, literally the media was essentially reporting many of the very basics of transit racism, boondoggle rail projects, and the fight for working class people in the city.
Well, I think one of the things know, to sort of mediate my guerrilla warfare theory, is we're also trying to train people to have the willingness to carry out the reform struggle in a revolutionary manner. So we're a strange organization. I mean, we talk, and we, as we know, we hold for this mass uprising, but you still got to go to the Air Quality Management District and try to fight on a specific rule that's going to try to, you know, limit diesel fuel from a refinery. And then you're going to go to the city council. And we didn't have the energy to take the mayor on like we took him on the buses. But, you know, next year we may be running a whole citywide campaign. Mr. Mayor, we want 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police. Stop the, you know, stop the attacks and the murders and the, you know, on the movement. So we didn't give them the same run for their money, but I think what we saw now is we did get 4 votes out of the MTA. We did push the mayor, right? In a way more, no question, more than he ever would have done without our campaign. And now we're going into court. We don't, you know, the courts have moved to the right, but we have, we think we have 2 strong cases to go into the Ninth Circuit, to go in on California Environmental Quality Act with NRDC. So it's a strange kind of thing. It's like the revolutionaries who in some way take the system more seriously than most people on the left, because we're simultaneously trying to build this movement independent of it, but we have to train the working class to be patient enough to fight through these bourgeois institutions, because otherwise we're sitting in the middle of nowhere just having a guerrilla army. So when, you know, so that's what I find always interesting, is I get discouraged. I say, no, you know, the system ain't gonna, you know, move. And then it's still a question that we're not finished with the relationship with Gloria Molina. We have another struggle tomorrow, right? The students at the high school, at Cleveland High School, you know, it's the biggest breakthrough we've had in the Valley. Maybe 5 years from now, some young Latino or black runs in the Valley, and we try to build a movement and alliance with forces, because I think this present generation of elected officials is dead. I just think they're a pretty pathetic group, and we work with them, but I don't see the cracks in them. But, you know, there's a point at which, you know, there's a historical moment, not just when we get better, but when some new forces do come out, and I think that's what we're working to do. And until then, whether they're dead or not, we got to work with them. It's sort of a contradiction.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I think that, you know, I think that that is the important aspect, and I think one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about this campaign also has been, you know, on one hand, the optimism of winning some new forces, and yet there seems to be almost a dictatorship, not only of elected officials, but of a whole plethora of other actors that, again, I think you described it earlier really well in terms of from certain forces in the church, even though it's a moment of contradictions in some ways, because on one hand, you know, we were able to win a massive amount of new forces into the struggle. I mean, people like, you know, Father Jay from Santo Tomas Church, or, you know, Father Estrada, Father Nieto, who are leaders in the immigrant right movements, who rightfully called on Gloria Molina and Yvonne Burke and Antonio Villaraigosa to talk about, as a person who comes out from such, you know, such a background, and who, in their propaganda, essentially, if this is their words, you talk about coming out of that same poverty, it's your moral responsibility to speak on it. And yet on the other end, you know, I would say, even if I were, if we were, me, myself, and Francisca Porchas, and Damon Azali, and the other organizers were able to deliver, you know, 6-7 pretty knockout people in the movement, from, you know, from civic leaders to religious leaders, there was probably another 20 calls that we made where calls weren't even returned, you know? And so I guess it's both the opportunity for us to see the hope in the folks that we're training, and yet also be very sober about what we're facing. And yet there was moments where I thought, hey, you know, we made a major breakthrough in this one, and I don't say that lightly, you know?
Well, I think you're right, and I think where the hope is sometimes you really got to say that, you know, it's maybe sounds metaphysical, but you don't know what contradictions are going to develop. Mm-hmm. You know, you don't know that's why, like, we didn't know we were going to get 1,500 people, and mm-hmm. we didn't know that we could even get the first six community leaders to take on the mayor and, you know, to take on the, you know, the bourgeoisie of color and the elected elite of color. And, you know, back to what we're asking our listeners, and we'll throw it to the phone, is if, you know, the Strategy Center, as individuals, we do get involved in some elections, and then we sit out some elections. Sometimes we just don't think there's any point. But some of us as individuals think there are times to intervene, like, you know, a lot of you didn't agree, but trying to build a united front against George Bush as individuals. You look for the contradictions that the actual world creates, and sometimes there is no objective choice, and sometimes there's, you know, splits in the ruling class where on one issue, you know, where our small but growing forces can have an impact. So very concretely, we still have a California Environmental Quality Act. It says that if you engage in new capital projects, which is what the MTA is doing with this money, you have to have an environmental impact report. Will you write a declaration if truly you will either be severely, and this must be primarily Black, Latino, and Asian Pacific Islander people, but it could be poor white people as well, or elderly, if you would be severely impacted by the fare increases and it would cause harm, and most importantly for the Air Quality Act, would this lead to you to either drive your car more, buy a car, or in any way contribute more emissions into the air? If you could cause a 213-387-2800, and basically be able to say to the court, I don't want to buy a car. I don't want to use my car more, but please stop the MTA from raising the fare. If you could be, I think it's called the declarant, and write a declaration, we would love your help. 213-387-2800. So, Manuel, should we go to the phones and see who's out there? Is there anybody out there?
Well, I think that's going to be important, folks. Call us at 818-985-5735. Again, it's 818-985-5735. You know, part of, again, from my perspective, the amazing work that folks hear on many of the shows here on KPFK, while not openly advocating for people to go out there, obviously we're able to maintain this story open for folks to be able to participate. So folks, give us a call at 818-985-5735, where we'd like to hear from you. Were you there that day? What did you experience? We know that the city department had to, the fire marshal had to close down MTA. So let's go to our first phone. It's Bella from Los Angeles. Welcome to the show, Bella.
Hi, guys. Thank you. Hello, Eric.
How you doing?
Hi there. I challenge everyone and anything that does not understand the signs of imperialism. So why are we still talking about the social injustices that all of us face on a daily basis? It's because we are not educating ourselves properly on the science itself of imperialism, why we are being suppressed, who supports it, what is the dynamic behind it, for what reason. Once we get to that education platform, we will begin to understand what is it that we need to identify. We are never able to identify the enemy because we work in patchwork and we work in a vacuum. And without that educational platform, we really cannot go forward, because everything we do is one step forward and several steps back. And by the way, I appreciate everything you guys are doing. It's a lot of work. I'm sorry that I personally have not been able to join you. I have my own challenges, but I'm writing my book, and I'm doing many things as an individual. I find that if I join organizations, I lose my own autonomy.
So what do you think, Manuel? Bella, that's great. Yeah. What do you think, Manuel?
I mean, obviously, yeah, I think that's part of the work. You know, at least we're always encouraging people to join an organization. Obviously, we have one part of what we think is the solution, and we have an organization that both looks at particular aspects of struggle, like the issue around, you know, mobility and civil rights here in Los Angeles, but yet we still have a worldview of the struggle, the principal struggle against U.S. imperialism, and our struggle is for the self-determination of folks. And I really encourage folks to go to our website. It's www.thestrategycenter.org, where people could get a chance to see both our vision of both a broad vision about how we understand the world forces and the forces that we need to win, and yet particular aspects of struggles here in Los Angeles and in the nation that we need to engage with. We have Dean from Orange. Welcome to the show, Dean.
Hi, thank you. Yeah, I'm calling from behind the orange curtain. I'm actually on a bus as we speak right now.
That's great.
But, you know, I actually choose to take the Metrolink and a bus just as a personal economic decision on my part. And I was just wondering, if you don't increase the fares, who's gonna, I mean, you want the middle class to support the whole transit structure for the buses? I mean, where's the money going to come from if you don't increase the fares?
Well, thanks, Dean. I mean, you know, I think obviously you know, again, I don't know if you were part of this discussion that we had earlier, where, again, this is all a shell game. This is a $3 billion agency. In no way is it bankrupt. And, again, I think it's a challenge on folks that want to be part of the struggle or want to support a struggle like this that need to understand that this is all about the construction of projects that will be at the hindrance and impact the folks that most depend on the system. And, again, the challenge back to you and folks who are listening out in the world is, what kind of system do we want to be able to build? Is it based on people's needs or based on, you know, a false notion of a project that won't necessarily at the end of the day?
I support light rail, though. I think light rail is good for the city.
So you think that 6 miles, we'll take your call outside, but at the end of the day, will 6 miles of $800 million would really be what we need in an area of 2,000 square miles here in Los Angeles? In other words, how do we depend on how to get somebody from South Los Angeles to the San Fernando Valley? Ultimately, a 6 mile project will never do that. And again, ultimately, this is a broader proposal and program to be able to create, you know, these so-called future communities in Los Angeles that will impact our folks right now in the moment. We have Chris from Riverside.
Hello?
Hello, Chris.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering why your guest, I'm sorry I don't remember his name, but why he mentioned every group and poor whites, almost saying that people that are white and have money don't take mass transit.
Eric, you want to take that one?
Yeah, my name is Eric Mann. I'm a co-host of the show.
Hi, Eric.
How you doing? Well, the first thing is that our theory is, if you look at the actual buses in downtown Los Angeles on Vermont, the 204 and things like that, the buses that we go on are not 80% black and Latino and Asian. They're 100% black and Latino and Asian. The LAUSD is, I don't know what, 85-90% black, Latino and Asian right now. Almost all the white people have left the public school system. So our emphasis in terms of who's the most oppressed, who's the most strategically important right now to change the society, is what we call the working class of color, the black, Latino, and Asian working class. But I added poor whites and whites in general, including white middle class people who testified, because they're very important too. We need more white allies. When we go to the MTA, and Manuel and I have gone for, I think he's gone for 8 years and I've gone for 12, when the poorest of the poor and the blackest of the black testify, we don't have a lot of white people, poor or otherwise, who even know where Cesar Chavez and Vignes is and will show up and say, hey, I'm here because this woman cannot afford the fare to go from 52 to 62, from 62 to 72. I'm an environmentalist. I'm a civil rights activist. So, yes, we're absolutely including white people, but we don't think white people are the center of the world, and they certainly are not the center of Los Angeles.
Well, of course they're not, but what I reject is you simply said poor white people. You didn't say middle-class white people or working-class white people.
So I added that. So I agree with you. I added that.
Well, just now you did, not in your original statement.
Well, I'm not running for president. I'm just trying to
explain. I didn't say you were, but it's the automatic mindset that people like you have is that white people that earn a living are evil.
No. What we're saying is that white middle-class people in general are racist. White middle-class people in general don't care about the black and Latino poor.
You proved you're racist by...
Wait. Look at the vote for Bush among white males was about 60%. the vote for Kerry, who didn't do a darn thing about civil rights. If you're a civil rights organizer, let me ask you a question.
Uh-huh.
How many white people, if you think it's a generalization, what percentage of white people do you think will fight for affirmative action if it led to a white person not getting a job in return for a black or Latino? How many whites would vote for that?
For affirmative action?
Yeah.
For whites?
No.
For blacks and Latinos?
Yeah. How many white people right now, what percentage of the white population supports an aggressive?
Nobody,
what?
Because it's ridiculous. It should be based on merit, not skin color.
Well, here's the answer. You're not one of them. So, there. I mean, don't you think that's interesting? I'm saying, I'm not calling you anything except to say, if one of my criteria, if you just accept this objectively,
okay,
in my view, it is racist, not you're a racist, it is racist to not support affirmative action. You say, how dare you call somebody racist, but then you come on and say, but I don't support affirmative action, right?
No, I didn't say anyone's a racist. I said it was kind of a racist attitude by mentioning just poor whites instead of whites in general, like you covered all the other races with a kind of a little cozy blanket.
Fair enough.
Okay.
Thanks, Chris. Now we got another caller, Mark from Los Angeles. Welcome to Voices from the Frontlines, Mark.
Yeah, I'd like to comment on the guy that just called. You know, the people that are taking...
Mark, we got about a minute, so help us out on this.
We actually need that. You know, we need the buses. We don't need light rail for some holiday weekend travelers. You know, these people depend on it for their livelihood, and then we could spread it out after we get things done, but we can't raise the rates. I can barely afford to move on it myself. Thank you.
Thanks, Mark. Give us a call at 213-387-2800. It's going to be very important for folks to support us on June the 16th at Emmanuel Presbyterian Church. We're going to go, where do we go now? Where do we go next? And, you know, obviously we had an amazing day on May 24th, and now how do we build from that movement? And I'm hoping that folks out in the world will support us for that. And I'd like to thank all the callers who called in for today's show. Eric, you want to give one last minute thought here?
No.
All right. So that's today's show, Voices from the Frontlines. This is your host, Manuel Criollo, and I'd like to thank our guest, Eric Mann, of course, and thank all the listeners who just called in. Today we had music from EFW, Johnny Cash, and Galople. We'd like to thank our producer, Alan Minsky, our production assistant, Lisa Adler, and Dehan Sung, as well as our engineer, D'Angelo Jones. And we'll see you next week for Voices from the Frontlines Radio. Up next is Beneath the Surface with Susie Wiseman.